It's always a good piece of advice to obey the boss. Now the boss, Scott, actually gave me certain instructions as to what I was supposed to do today, and I'm going to slightly add a little bit. So please, Scott, forgive me. I'm going to try and enlarge the background for that particular story, that very clever story that Jesus told. I want to begin with the little town of Bethany, which is mentioned in our readings, because it was that town where Jesus' friends, Lazarus, Mary and Martha, that's where they lived. They were obviously very wealthy because they actually stayed in their house, Jesus and his disciples, from time to time. And goodness me, that would mean a very large residence. They're an interesting family in that there are just the three of them. There's no mum and dad involved. Generally, mum and dad have died. None of them are married. So there are two women. They're not married. And there's this brother who does appear to have had a sort of a sickly past, and he ends up dying. You're familiar with the story, probably. Jesus actually knows what's going on. He knows this is going to be an occasion where God is going to be glorified immensely. Lazarus, the only male in the family, is dead. But Jesus is well aware a four-day dead man, because that's what it would end up being, a four-day dead man would come back from the world of the dead, and Jesus would be the one who would bring him back from the dead. He stands outside and yells out, "Lazarus!" outside the tomb. "Lazarus, here, outside." And a four-day dead man comes out, and Jesus says to people, "Get those burial clothes off him. Get those off him. Let him go." An astonishing situation. Just before that happened, however, and I hope that you'll see the relevance of this, Scott. very wise to obey the boss. Just before that happened, when Jesus actually arrives in the vicinity of where Mary and Martha lived, there's been a crowd from Jerusalem that have come out to sympathise with the sisters about the death of their brother, And Mary is actually in the residence, and word comes from Martha, "Look, Jesus is actually coming. He's not far away." And Mary gets out of the house quickly, and she goes to meet where Jesus is, not very far away, and a crowd goes with her, a crowd of weepers. No, actually it's more stronger than that. They're sobbers. They sob. They're meant to sort of be with her in her great tragedy. And it is Mary and the group that's with her that go to meet Jesus, and they are sobbing. They're sobbing. It's described of Jesus that he weeps. Now, there are two different Greek words associated with weeping. One has to do with a gentle weeping, and the other has to do with sobbing, almost uncontrollable. Mary and a crowd with her are weeping almost uncontrollably. "We've lost our only brother." Jesus, however, weeps quietly. It's the other Greek word. Why does he weep at all? Jesus can't remove himself from the suffering of other people. He recognizes their sorrow, and he himself is moved. But he weeps quietly. I take it because he knows what he is about to do and bring Lazarus back from the world of the dead. And now let's catch up with our readings. It's this same town where there's going to be a colt for Jesus to ride upon. And Jesus sits upon this ass, the colt of an ass. And there's a very large number of people, probably because, you see, Passover is just around the corner. This is the Sunday before the Friday when Jesus is killed, Friday night. And nonetheless, there is a group of people there who actually recognize Jesus to be extraordinary. When you think about it, if you were asked to describe Jesus, what sort of words would you use? It'd be interesting if we had a quiz and we all contributed. What sort of words would you use? Sorry? Kind. Kind, absolutely, that would be. I didn't ask for hands up, but look, thank you very much, because that's a wonderful thing to say. Absolutely kind. When you look at the account that we have here, I don't know what words you would want to come up with to describe him. I find the word extraordinary just not good enough. He's incredibly tough, as it were, and that's an unusual word. You don't find that written in the New Testament about Jesus, but words are like that, though. He has set his face determined that he will go to Jerusalem, and in the end he will die. And he knows that, just as he knew about the death of Lazarus. Irresolute, absolutely determined. At the same time, he's a man completely in control, completely in control. He talks about how to get the colt of the ass. The colt of the ass arrives, and he sits upon it. And the crowd that actually, you know, there are some people who really do believe in him, and they do believe he's the Messiah or something like it. And you've got these people shouting out as they see him, and they treat him like a royal king. It's a reflection of some stuff from the Old Testament. They treat him, there he is, sitting on a colt of an ass, and they lay their clothes before him. Let the colt, as it were, go on cushions. That's deserving for a king. And the crowd yell out some words like this: "Oh, you know, glory to God! Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven, glory in the highest." Now, not everyone believes that this is the great one. Pharisees get a mention here. The Pharisees say, "You know, this is disrespectful to God that people should be yelling out like this." Something like that would be in the back of their minds, or the sort of things that they would say. Stop that. Make the crowd stop and behave like normal human beings, as it were. Jesus said, look, if they were to be stopped, the very stones would cry out. Very graphic sort of metaphor. The very stones would cry out. Now we're getting closer to our readings, aren't we? Now Jesus would have actually, coming from that town, you actually have an ascent to what's called the Mount of Olives. And the Mount of Olives is surrounded by a number of trees, shrubs, and so on. And he gets to the top, and he starts to go down the other side when that crowd is crying out, you know, wow, blessed be, you know, the man who comes in the name of the Lord. And as he comes out of the groves of the trees, he then can see the enormous city of Jerusalem. In its day, it was absolutely huge. In its day, if you happened to come when, in fact, the sun was rising and it was shining on the city itself, it would illuminate the temple. The temple was extraordinary in its own right, and it would be dazzling. You'd see this golden image before you. The walls were enormously thick. It was a great fort. That's what it had been centuries and centuries before. It was extraordinary, you see, that it was actually overcome and dealt with by David. He actually had to attack this fort. But here it was. And in the eyes of Jesus, when he sees Jerusalem, it says, as it were, he sees the very center, the focus of God with his people Israel. This is God's city, God's reigning city, God's kingly city. And he sees this great city. Peace in heaven, the crowd had shouted out. And now Jesus sobs. It's the Greek word for almost crying uncontrollably. He weeps when he sees Mary and the crowd who are so distressed about the death of Lazarus. When he sees a city, a walled city, a fortress, an enormous fortress, but it's the center, as it were, the focus, the physical focus of God's reign over his own people. He sobs. Because peace is not for you, he basically says. War will come upon you. They will build, as it were, they will completely surround the city. They will build ramparts. They will knock the walls to the very ground, together with you and your children. You will be taken into captivity, is the sort of thing that's in the image. He sobs because he cares for the people of God. But many of Israel do not care for him. Well, it's very hard to work out exactly what happens in the next few days, what happens every single day. But if you read the four Gospels together, it appears that on this occasion, he goes into the city itself. It's fairly late in the afternoon, and he has a look around, and he goes out. But maybe it's the very next day. He seems to go up to the city almost every day in the next few days before Friday, when he's actually, you know, arrested over in the Mount of Olives area and then brought before the Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin was the ruling council of the Jewish people. Very, very powerful. Rome had given the Sanhedrin certain authorities that they could, you know, appeal to in their own right. It consisted of three main groups: the chief priests, a sort of family of affair, a very sort of noble, so-called, elevated group of people, very high flyers, and scribes. They were supposed to be the intelligentsia. They were the academics of the day. That was the second group of people belonging to the Sanhedrin, and then the third, the elders, are supposedly a group of wise people. And those three together ruled over Israel. And here you've got Jesus turning up. On perhaps the very next day, and he turns up in the city itself. And one of the things he does is to so act as to say to people, you should recognize what some of your leaders are involved in. And they're involved in just making money. What he does is he goes into that area of the court of the Gentiles. The court of the Gentiles was massive. I've actually seen someone refer to how many hectares it covered, and I won't quote them to you because I still find it unbelievable. But in fact, it was a very extensive sort of circular court around the main temple itself. It went for something like, or maybe 250 to 400 metres in length, and I'm not sure how deep it was, but it was an enormous area. And it was where business was conducted to make money. Under the approval, with the approval, presumably, of the Sanhedrin. Otherwise, they could have stopped it. Two things are described. And this is probably only the second, not the first time, probably the second time at least, when Jesus did the same thing. He walks into the court of the Gentiles, that area that surrounds the temple, and he sees money changers. Oh, look, you need to pay, you're coming along, you want to worship God? Oh, you'll need to pay a tax, of course, and you'll need to give some money to the temple, and the tax will have to be because we can't accept any money. We've only accept temple money. Well, we've got the temple money, and we'll need to exchange your money that comes from the outside world. You'll need to give that to us, and we'll give you some temple money, and of course you'll pay a tax. Who gets the tax? We do, of course. And then he goes, and Jesus is so angry. See, would you have used this word, be kind? And now you would have used the word angry, because he's angry. And he overturns the table. He seems to have actually taken control of the court of Gentiles. To do that, someone actually whom I read who works in this area said that probably he would have used the 11 or so disciples to actually take over control. They prevented people from walking through. They prevented people from getting to the tables and so on. So he physically knocks that table to its ground where the money changers were. Then he goes over and there's a table where, and this is for poor people. There were doves on this table. You see, if you're too poor to actually use a normal animal for sacrifice to God, well then you won't have to pay very much. You could pay a little bit for a dove. But again, you can't use impure money. You've got to use pure money. See, stuff that comes from the temple. Use that, and that's okay. And of course, you'll pay a tax. The tax in the end will come to us. And what Jesus does is he overturns that table as well. And he quotes from the Old Testament. This is written, it's written that this is a house of prayer for God. You've turned it into a place for evil people to make money, lovers of money. That's in effect what he says. This is angry Jesus. Now, the scribes, the Pharisees, it doesn't get them mentioned in this particular gospel, the high priestly group, you know, the priest group, the chief priests, they're not going to take this lying down. They're furious with Jesus because he's actually attacking them. He's actually attacking them. And they make it one stage, they demand, look, who this is in the temple complex, Who gave you this sort of authority to act this way? Where do you get your authority from? Jesus, now we've got to say, clever Jesus. Jesus says, well, let me ask you a question. You know, John the Immerser, I prefer to call him that rather than John the Baptist. I think it's more descriptive. It's just a translation of the word. John the Immerser, did he come from God? Like, is he a prophet of God, or is he just a sort of ordinary man? Tell me the answer to that question. If you do, I'll give you an answer to your question. And they say, oh, look, they're a bit worried. Because generally people thought that John the Immerser was a prophet from God. There was a general reverence paid to this man that had lived the rough life down the River Jordan area. And they say, oh, sorry, we don't know the answer to that question. Well, I'm not telling you, I'm not giving you an answer to your question either. I don't know how to, shrewd Jesus. Isn't he extraordinary? He's more than extraordinary. Anyway, then he tells the parable of the tenants, the people who to whom a vineyard is rented out. Again, I think you have to say, this is very clever. Jesus in his parables, parables of Jesus with any length to them are very carefully constructed. They're not just simple stories. The particular parable that Jesus now tells is a bit like a ladder with two parts to it, you know, this side and that side. And you start the story over here and you work your way up to the top of the story and then you work your way down. It's not that there are pieces in the story that are unimportant. They're all important. One of the things is, though, what's at the top? Now, some of the parables of Jesus have a different construction, but this particular parable has this construction. So you have the beginning of the story, some important element, very, very important element in the story, and then the story finishes. So what's got to happen here, by the way, is when Jesus tells a story, he tells it to a crowd that will be able to interpret, as it were, the backdrop to the story. So that as the story unfolds, you have an image in your mind. Oh, yes, I understand. Yes, I can see what might have been. And you will fill in, as it were, backdrops that make it, as it were, more vivid. It'll be automatic, you see, and you live in a world where storytelling is not uncommon. And so Jesus tells a story, and he says there was a certain man, unknown, a certain man, and he leaves the country. He goes a fair way away, you know, so it's going to be a long distance away. But he's actually planted a vineyard, so he's already, that's his business, it's his vineyard, they're his vines. But if he's going to go away, and basically that means he, with all his big household, he's a fairly wealthy to-do person, you see. If he's going to do that, he's going to have to have people who look after the vineyard, protect it, nurture it, make sure it's free of disease and so on. And when the time comes, when the grapes are ripening and so on, he's going to actually come and say, well, now, you know, I want some grapes out of this, and I want some money out of this and so on, as they'll be sold and whatever. And also, of course, you are getting a benefit by staying on my vineyard, and you are entitled to a rent. They will get a rent. That's the backdrop. That's the sort of stuff that you would fill in. Say, yeah, I understand. So a certain man, he plants a vineyard, but he goes away, you know, far away, is this sort of idea. And he gets some tenants in who agree. There's an agreement, see? There's a contract that's actually established. They agree that they will actually look after the vineyard. They will live in that area. And when the time comes, when the grapes ripen and so on, they'll be giving certain grapes to the owner of the vineyard. That will be their rent at least, and that's no problem whatsoever. So he goes away. He goes away into a far country, and he's planted the vineyard, and there it is. And now what happens is the owner of the vineyard, the time has come. He's got word. The grapes are ripe. He sends a slave. The word is actually, the English translations tend to make it a bit more sober than that, but it means that the person basically has no rights, completely under the control, had very few rights, completely under the control of the certain man, who's later on described as master or lord. A servant is sent, and it's a very simple matter. The servant is sent and says to the renters of the vineyard, people who are residing there, looking after the vines, give us some stuff, and presumably it'll get sold, and money will accrue or whatever to the master. And what happens in the story is that, as you're going up this rung of the ladder, as it were, what happens in the story is that they basically seize the servant. He's only a slave. So, you know, slaves have very few rights. They seize him. They beat him. We're not going to take notice of you. You're just a slave. Yeah, you expect us to sort of turn... We're growing fond of the place. We like it here. And they send him away with nothing. Yeah. You can imagine, if you're filling in the story, when news gets back to the owner of the vineyard, they actually beat you? Oh, I suppose they just saw you as unimportant. I'll send a second slave. Surely there's a misunderstanding here. They don't realise. So a second slave comes with the same request. You know, pay the rent. And what happens is now actually, as you're going up the ladder, the treatment of the second slave is slightly worse. See? They manhandle him. They really do beat him severely. And they throw him out. There's no rent to be paid. And word gets back to the owner, the master, and this is very difficult to believe. I'll send a third slave. This misunderstanding here is a sort of backdrop. Surely they'll take notice of the third. You know, they'll realise that, look, the master is serious. He wants the rent. So the third slave comes, and now they treat him even more severely. See, there's a gradation in this. And they wound him, and they fling him out. It's worse. Now we're pretty well at the top, pretty well at the top. People have been sent, and at the top we've got the master, the lord of the vineyard. He sort of thinks to himself, and he says, obviously the thing to do maybe, perhaps if I send my son, not a slave at all. And now he adds a word which, in a sense, from the point of view of the story at this point, was unnecessary for Jesus to put. Jesus is the creator of this story. Don't forget that. In the story that Jesus creates, he has the master saying, perhaps if I send my son, my beloved, he didn't need to put that in, but it's important. It is very important. This is the crux. Perhaps if I sent my son, my beloved son, they'll respect him. So he sends his son. And so down the other side, you've had the slaves being sent, now the son's being sent. When the son turns up, obviously, but in terms of his clothing, in terms of his manner, in terms of his demeanour, perhaps he announces who he is, the son of the master has arrived. And now wicked people do what wicked people like to do. They like to plan their wickedness, but you've got to do it with friends. So you get together in a little huddle. And they get together in a huddle. The son doesn't hear all this. And they're appealing to a law of the land. And this is filled in for you because you are familiar with the backdrop. The law of the land was this. If you occupy a piece of land for 3 years and that's completely unbroken, you have squatter's rights and the land is yours. That's what comes into their thinking. Ah. To tell you what, they say to one another, if we kill the son, there's nobody else of any strength that's going to demand anything from us. And you would read into it. And if we hang on to this for 3 years, it'll be ours. We take control. By the way, later on, if you were thinking about this and trying to understand certain things about it, you might say to yourself, gosh, I wonder whether at this point in the story, Jesus is indicating something about the nature of human beings who reject him. They want to take control. They want to take control of their own world. How insulting that is to God, the Creator and Lord over all. How dare human beings operate that way? We all have, to some extent. So they kill the son. And now the story is basically finished, except that Jesus now, as it were, takes himself out of the story and asks this question. What then will the master do to those who've killed his son? He will come and he will destroy them. And he will put in their place another group of people, obviously better fitted for it, is the way you'd see it. Now, at this point, if you're listening to this, by the way, and it's absolutely clear that the chief priests or the priests and the scribes, they understand that the story is leveled at them. They're not that stupid. There's tremendous animosity between them and Jesus. And Jesus creates a terrible scenario in terms of destruction of those who will not recognize the Son of God for whom he is, the Beloved One. And someone, maybe more than one, yells out something like, it's a bit hard to translate, something like, oh, this mustn't be, this mustn't be. What mustn't be? To be replaced by another group of people. And this is Luke's gospel, by the way, a gospel written to the Gentile world. And maybe, you see, you are meant to understand that when the other people are referred to, the other people refer to many of the Gentiles. What? Many of the Gentiles take our place? I don't know whether anyone at the time understood it that way. But later on, if you were reading it, you could understand it that way easily. That the Gentiles basically would take over and see Jesus for who he really is, the Beloved Son of God. When someone from the crowd yelled out, no, that mustn't be, that mustn't be. They're just attacking them. Jesus says, well, then what are you going to make of the scriptures which says that the stone that the builders rejected, the builders are responsible for educating the people of God as to how they should live and whom they should recognize as the Messiah. The stone that the builders rejected has become head of the corner. It becomes the means by which you align the whole structure of God's kingdom. The focus is on Jesus. What then, you see, will happen? Those who fall upon this stone that God puts in as the chief capstone, the big thing that round which everything else is constructed. If you fall on this stone, Jesus warns them, you'll be broken to pieces. And whoever this stone falls upon will be crushed. And now, the enemy, what do? They say, Jesus, we've been so stupid, we've been ignoring the obvious, your great, powerful, mighty works. Of course you are the Messiah. Did they do that? No. They now want to kill him, arrest him immediately. Immediately, now, it must not go any further. This man is not to be allowed to utter these things. But they cannot arrest him straight away because there's too many other people there who love him. Can't do it. Can't do it. Well, just very briefly, what sort of stuff do we learn? I hope we've already learned a lot. I learn a lot just looking at it. Thank you, Scott, for putting me up with me again and inviting me. Jesus is irrelevant. He absolutely resolved, and he will not depart from it. He will go to Jerusalem, and in the end, he will die. That's clear. It doesn't matter if you make enemies on the way. It doesn't matter if you make enemies so badly that they actually want to arrest you and kill you almost on the spot. It doesn't matter. He will go to Jerusalem, and in the end, he will die. He will die for us. Absolutely resolute. He's not going to be put off by putting into public the sins of those in high positions who should have known better. He makes it clear that those sins can't be covered. Those sins are obvious. And he's going to stick up for the honour of his father by referring to him as the one who had a beloved son. And secondly, you see in this parable and what surrounded it, you see the central focus of God. It's the beloved Son's the central focus. Forget about even the great prophets, and there may be a little reference in the parable to the prophets in the past who were, you know, rejected, beaten, thrown away, not to be. There may be that. But it all has to do with the Son. God's plans revolve around the Son. And maybe the third thing for us to recognize is, under the great kindness of God, many Gentiles, I take it like you and me, for most of us, many Gentiles have come under the great blessing of God Himself, and we have become members of His kingdom, the true Israel of God. You got any comments or questions? If you have, someone might need to shout them out for me because my hearing's not great. Actually, I'd learnt the benefit of not having a good hearing sometimes, but if you might have some comments or questions. You don't have to. You don't get any money or anything, no prizes. Okay. Why don't I pray? Heavenly Father, thank you for coming into the world in the person of your Son. Not deserving in any way. You have been so kind to us and you have shown us the way of truth. Thank you for revealing to us again the nature of your Son. How horrific it would be. It will be for those who do not recognize him. As we approach our Good Friday and Easter Sunday, please help us to see where there might be opportunities to invite a friend, a neighbour, a relation along to hear more about you. Because we want you glorified. We want you to be recognised as who you are. Amen.